Welcome to Why Is This Good, a podcast by the Naples Writers Workshop. I'm Christine and I'm here with John. Hey, John.
Hello.
Okay, it was my turn and I picked a story called The Veldt by Ray Bradbury, and I'm going to read a section. The lions came running at them. Lydia bolted and ran. Instinctively, George sprang after her. Outside in the hall with the door slammed, he was laughing and she was crying, and they both stood appalled at the other's reaction. George, Lydia, oh my dear, poor sweet Lydia. They almost got us. Walls, Lydia, remember? Crystal walls, that's all they are. Oh, they look real, I must admit. Africa in your parlor, but it's all dimensional. Super reactionary, super sensitive color film and mental tape film behind glass screens. It's all odor phonics and sonics, Lydia. Here's my handkerchief. I'm afraid. She came to him and put her body against him and cried steadily. Did you see? Did you feel? It's too real. Now, Lydia, you've got to tell Wendy and Peter not to read any more on Africa. Of course, he patted her. Promise? Sure. And lock the nursery for a few days until I get my nerves settled. You know how difficult Peter is about that. When I punished him a month ago by locking the nursery for even a few hours, the tantrum he threw, and Wendy too, they live for the nursery. It's got to be locked. That's all there is to it. All right. Reluctantly, he locked the huge door. You've been working too hard. You need a rest. I don't know. I don't know, she said, blowing her nose, sitting down in a chair that immediately began to rock and comfort her. Maybe I don't have enough to do. Maybe I have time to think too much. Why don't we shut the whole house off for a few days and take a vacation? You mean you want to fry my eggs for me? Yes, she nodded. And darn my socks? Yes. A frantic, watery-eyed nodding. And sweep the house? Yes, oh yes. But I thought that's why we bought this house, so we wouldn't have to do anything. That's just it. I feel like I don't belong here. The house is wife and mother now, and nurse. Made. Can I compete with an African veldt? Can I give a bath and scrub the children as efficiently or quickly as the automatic scrub bath can? I cannot. And it isn't just me, it's you. You've been awfully nervous lately. I suppose I have been smoking too much. You look as if you don't know what to do with yourself in this house either. You smoke a little more every morning and drink a little more every afternoon and need a little more sedative every night. You're beginning to feel unnecessary too. Okay, yeah, so like I said, I'm not sure how I came across this one. I really can't remember. And I know we've done Ray Bradbury before, and I know a lot of it is this kind of like concept of families living in these houses that kind of like do things for them.
Oh, one of the things I loved about this story is like, this is the house before there will come soft rains when everything's destroyed. This is like what the house was with people living in it.
Right. Yeah. And that's really what it felt like. I like how on the first page here, I didn't read this section, but there's a paragraph in the very beginning. It says they walked down the hall of their soundproofed happy life home, which had cost them $30,000 installed. And there's just like little, like that was where I underlined it and said, oh, it's more sci-fi. Like you can just tell like immediately that it's like of a time and place where the technology is at its height. It's at its peak. And I think people kind of forget that science fiction doesn't have to be like spacecraft. It can
Oh,
just be
yeah.
like really advanced technology that doesn't exist in the time and place when it was written. But in the 50s, people really did think that there'd be robots, I guess, like, flipping our eggs for us.
I mean, there's that Asimov story I read where the kid wanted to walk to school through the outdoors, and the mother's
Yeah.
like, I don't know what's wrong with
Yeah,
him.
yeah. So there's a lot of the same kind of conclusion is drawn when your house or when your life is too comfortable, like the things that you end up like craving out of it are things that we thought we were protecting ourselves from. So I like that whole concept. So the section I read talks about like how they feel unnecessary in their own home. I have this concept where like any of the workplaces I've ever been where people gossip a lot, I think it's because there's not enough work to do. Like if you're so bored, you like crave like the stimulation somewhere else. And this family is like, everything is too easy for them. And so the kids end up craving this horrific African veldt. Maybe that's repetitive, but they keep going into the nursery and watching this like immersive screen of lions eating prey. And there's a line where the kid is like talking to the dad who's threatened to close it up. And he's like, I don't want to do anything but look and listen and smell. What else is there to do? He just wants to like observe. He wants to be entertained, right? Because toiling and working is not, there's no pleasure in that, especially if it's better done by something else. There's another section here that I highlighted where it was like, so this is right after the section that I read where the parents sit down for dinner and their kids are at a carnival. But it says the children thought zebras and there were zebras, sun, giraffes, giraffes. giraffe's death and death. That last, he chewed tastelessly on the meat at the table that the table had cut for him. Death thoughts. They were awfully young. Wendy and Peter for death thoughts. Or no, you were never too young, really. Long before you knew what death was, you were wishing it on someone else. When you were 2 years old, you were shooting people with cat pistols. But this, the long, hot African veldt, the awful death in the jaws of a lion, and repeated again and again. And like, there's something about like these kids, they just like, everything is so comfortable that they just crave this like violence and like this brutality and like something going wrong. And like he's saying, he's like, well, I guess, you know, we've always kind of played with guns and stuff, but this is different. I'm like, yeah, your kids are coddled. Like they want something like horrific. They want to go to war. You don't like ever hear about like kids that like worked in factories as child laborers complaining about being bored. You know what I mean? These kids are bored.
I think it's important to the story that their names are Wendy and Peter.
Yes, yes. That's a good point.
This is childhood. This is like, it's on a theme of like, what is childhood, right? Or how do kids cling to childhood or something? And these kids wind up killing their parents so that they can keep their childhood nursery.
I wonder, like, I guessed it with like 3 pages to go. I made like a little note. It says, they're gonna eat the parents. Like, I could tell that, like, well, like, I think there's signs really early on where the dad goes to, like, look at the veldt and he finds his own wallet.
Because the story sets up a mystery. What is it? What are they eating? There's, like, bones. There's vultures.
In the distance? And, that sound is familiar.
You get that feeling that, like, okay, the story is establishing a question. A good story is going to answer that question by the end. So we expect to have an answer. And so we're trying to guess along the way, right?
Yeah. Yeah, and it's not hard to guess. It's just kind of like...
Like, how is that possible? Why does that happen? Sets up all these like circumstances and rules and stuff, and you have to like figure out how it works to make sense of what the scenario seems to be.
Yeah, it's almost like what they're seeing on the screen is like it's their future, but it's already happened. Like every time they see the lions, they're actually just eating them. They've always been eating them, and it's like story of your life or whatever, where like time is not chronological. They're like arriving at this like destiny. That's what it feels like when you're reading it. It just feels like this has already come to pass. This is not something that like anyone has an option out of. I mean, there's so many like equivalents for this kind of sci-fi stuff, which is why it feels timeless, right? This is published in the 50s, but you can equate it to like kids these days just want to look at their tablets, right?
Oh, yeah.
And then the parents will get like a wild hair up their ass and decide that they're taking the tablets away. But even they can only hold to that for so long before they're annoyed by their kid. And then they give in and give the tablet back.
TVs, radio, books, everything was destroying the youth.
Oh, I love the book comparison because people are always like, oh, get off your computer. Get off your phone and read a book. And I'm like, you know, I don't have tech neck, but I do when I read books. And you don't know what I'm reading. I could be reading absolute garbage. You know what I mean? Just because it's written doesn't mean that I'm consuming something that's good for me necessarily. Maybe the act, I buy that the act of reading is better for my brain. But anyway, like these parents have just lost control a little bit, right? And they're trying to get it back, but it's too late. And then what's interesting here is that the parents get punished.
Yeah.
I think we usually worry about like kids that become so addicted to their iPads that like they lack social skills, or they grow up and they want instant gratification, or they become insufferable little assholes, whatever it is. And here it's like, no, the real consequence is that the parents get punished. The parents get eaten alive by lions. And maybe if more parents read this, they'd take the iPads away, right? Like, it's just an interesting like placement of the danger. The kids are not the ones that get eaten by the lions, even though the parents are convinced that that's what might happen.
Yeah, it's almost like a Lord of the Flies kind of thing. It's like the kids, the authority figure stands up and they're like, no, we want this thing, so you have to die.
Well, and also like you could argue like with that comparison that the kids have been raised by the screen, and so they've adopted their own set of rules and morals that the parents are just like not aware of. They've completely lost standing as like being the moral authority. So they're like, this is bad for you. And the kids are like, here's the thing, we need it and we want it. And you'll give it to us. And they're like, what?
They try to take away. They talked about it, letting them turn it on one last time.
Yeah, the one last time thing was wild to me. I like that it's sort of timeless that way. And it is always of the most current technology and the idea that it's going to permanently damage kids. But I like that there's like a punishment and it is scary.
Everything you read about where they complain about some new technology, like screens for kids and stuff, every story will always reference like the history of like people at the same complaint. complaint about TVs. People had the same complaint about radio, but they'll often go back to Socrates had the same complaint about writing. He didn't want people to write things down because he said, if you write it down, then you'll rely on the written thing instead of remembering it for yourself.
Oh my God.
Yeah. Or being able to derive it again, like with his Socratic method.
Right.
But everything is always destroying the youth. Everything, always.
Yeah. And it's always some version of like a technology that delivers information, but is too entertaining for its own good. Like people would argue that like children's books with too many pictures might be bad or something. And it's like, dude, whatever gets them to crack a book, like where do you draw the line? And here, I think what makes this like a little more believable in terms of the African veldt and the screen being truly damaging is that like the kids are not required to do anything but observe. And they do it repeatedly. It's the same thing.
Well, this is like, it's almost like the Star Trek holodeck. And people always joke that the holodeck will be the last invention because then everyone's just going to go into the holodecks and like live out fantasy lives because they don't have to be in the real world anymore. They can just make up anything they want.
Right.
And this is like, this is the 1950 version of that where it's like,
yeah, of the Sims.
They just get lost in there. They just want to be in there.
Right. Yeah. There's certain versions though of like things like the Sims where that's an escape from what is a difficult life. And these kids are so coddled that they seek the alternate. They seek something like thrilling.
Yeah.
I only point that out because I think that that's what seems common in his sci-fi specifically. Like we're talking about like There Will Come Soft Rains and how like the house just keeps going, but there's no one to like serve. And it's the same idea where these people could just like wake up and like robots would dress them and cook for them. And or in the other story that you mentioned that we've talked about where the kid just wants to walk outside. He just wants to like experience something like raw and natural that's not like catering to him. So like the danger being that like, not that we want to escape our difficult lives, but that we humans want to work, you know?
Yeah.
They want to experience something.
The other story was where they're on Venus and the sun only came out for like a short amount of time and they locked that kid in the closet so he couldn't experience it.
That was fucked up. I forgot about that. But I mean, like think about like house cats. Like you take a house cat out of the wild, they stop hunting, they just get fed and they sleep all day and they seem like really comfortable and lazy. But if you ever like go to the vet because your cat's been peeing where it shouldn't be peeing, they always talk about giving it enrichment. They're like, maybe give it something to do. Maybe make something a little more exciting. All the cat is doing is laying around all day. No wonder it's acting out. It's bored as shit.
Yeah.
These kids are just like, they're bored. So they're like, let's watch the lions eat mom and dad.
The characters make comments about like the parents. They talk about how things don't want to die. Even rooms don't want to die. So the room is almost like fighting back too. It's almost giving agency to the room.
Yeah.
The nursery being like, because the kids can control it, it like has figured out how to, and this is kind of reading into, this isn't spelled out, but if it has that kind of agency where it doesn't want to die, then you can assume that it has been feeding the kids certain imagery so that it can like condition them to want to go back to the veldt and want to go back to the lion so that it can eventually get those parents that are threatening to turn it off, right?
Yeah. Yeah, that's a really good point. Like the room also has an agenda here and the kids are maybe just the pawns.
Maybe.
Well, like the room wants to stay alive. It wants to stay working. Yeah. It wants to keep doing its thing. That's what it was made to do. And so if in order to do that, it has to make the kids feel X, Y, and Z, then it will. Imagine if we thought about our phones that way. I mean, we do, right? I mean, we know.
Algorithm. That's what the algorithm does. Right? Yeah. It wants your attention. And so feeds you things that give attention.
But we also know that like we could in theory throw this thing in the river.
Easy.
It's not going to crawl out of the water. Yeah. But like there is something about like the technology itself. Like you said, it's just like we know that everything's designed to keep us engaged constantly and needing it and almost against our will. But this just takes it to the next sci-fi level, which is that there's an actual danger that you could be eaten by it.
It is interesting. So these are all very human things. Like we are talking about like universal, like it's almost timeless. Even though it's very 1950 science fiction, it's also timeless in the sense that we can apply it to like our phones. We can apply it to Socrates and his idea about writing, books, radio, TV, all the things that distract kids, all the technologies that are, we question whether or not they're good for us. And so in that way, it's very universal. It's very human. But I always react to these characters. Like they talk in such a weird way. I'm reminded of that story, the Fitzgerald story, Curious Case case of Benjamin Button, where it's like the baby, quote unquote, baby was born as like a 90-year-old man. And like the guy's trying to put a diaper on him. Like he's treating him as if he's baby, not as if he's a 90-year-old man. And you're like, who would do that? Like that doesn't feel like a real person would do that. So it's almost like a cartoony kind of version of a person. And these people feel almost cartoony. Like they don't seem to get what's going on.
Right.
They're not thinking deeply about it. They're just kind of, and part of that is the house has conditioned them to just like, I just lay here and like the house does everything for me. So I don't have to think deeply about anything. It's almost like the Harrison Bergeron kind of situation, right?
Yeah.
So you want to like grab these characters and like shake them. Like you're not a real person. You're not acting the way a real person should act, even though the story is getting at real human concerns.
Right.
So that's an interesting feature of fiction, that you can have cartoon kind of like not quite real feeling humans. Like our last story, Laurie Moore created like this really clear, detailed character with like very concrete, specific emotions that were evoked by that character in that situation. And you could understand because it was so specific. Where this is much more generalized, but still you get the very human feelings and human concerns out of it. It can go both ways. It can be either very specific or very general, and you can get that idea out of it. We always talk about how important details are and how important being specific and concrete is for fiction. This demonstrates you don't have to. I mean, you still do a little bit, but it's not as imperative as we sometimes suggest it is.
No, I think like a lot of times like sci-fi, the concept, the premise is like what the writers are concerned with, and the characters can be a little flatter because it's supposed to apply to everyone somehow. We're supposed to be like in awe of the horrors of the technology. And so any character with general sensibility. Yeah. But I think chalk it up to like the 50s, because like all these like characters that we're talking about, like Harrison Bergeron or like Button or We Can Remember It For You Wholesale, all these stories that are like sci-fi-ish, the characters are flat, but they're also just like the common folk. They feel like the everyday man and woman living together, minding their own business, and then something horrible happens. And I guess I've always read these and assumed that above all else in that time and day, like the culture was to be polite. And so like their reactions are like muted, you know, and they're kind of always
polite.
Like, yeah, they just seem like wildly polite. Like the button thing, she's like, I don't want that. No, thank you. And then she's like, whatever are you doing? I don't want this button. Like, what do you mean a lot of money? And her and the husband are like, well, you know, if somebody dies and we don't know who they are, it's not a big deal. Like it feels like that's maybe how they actually talked. I don't know. But I do feel like we are consistently encountering them in the sci-fi world. So maybe you're right. Maybe this is just like a factor of these characters. They can be flat because that's not what we're supposed to be like paying attention to. They can be like sort of hard to imagine or believe.
Or easy to imagine and believe. Like you don't have to put a lot of work into understanding them as characters because they're not the focus.
No, there's just like some behavior even by these parents in this story that is like a little confounding. They're like,
yeah, that's true. Yeah.
We should really close the nursery. And then they don't. And you're like, what?
Yeah, I mean, it seems dangerous what's happening there. Lions are eating something.
Exactly.
Like, there's something wrong with that room. We don't have to turn off the whole house, but let's just turn off that room just for a little bit until we get a tech out here to check out what's happening.
Well, then they bring the like psychologist out and he's like, yeah.
A psychologist? Why a psychologist?
I know. I'm like, yeah, why not a Comcast guy?
That's right. We need IT personnel.
I think there's something satisfying too, though, when, like I said, I kind of guessed before the story was completely over that like that's where this was going. I don't think it was hard to guess, right?
Yeah.
A lot of times, like I read a story and I'm like, yeah, there's an impending sense of doom, but I don't specifically know what the outcome is going to be. This was like pretty obvious. It was like the parents are getting eaten, or they already have been, or that's the familiar scream in the background is like their death playing
out.
Yeah,
I didn't realize it was circular like that. I was thinking it was every time they went in there and they saw the bones or something, I was thinking, oh, one of the kids got eaten, and then they didn't realize it, or they shouldn't have turned it back down because now the lions ate at the kids.
Yeah.
But discovering it was them, it's like, oh, that's interesting.
Yeah. But there's something in these stories where we see it in horror movies a lot, you know, not just sci-fi, but like in horror and specifically movies where you're screaming at the screen. You're like, why would you do that? Like there needs to be an element of the characters doing things that you know they shouldn't do, or else like this might be just drawn out or resolved properly, right? Like characters have to do things that you just just know are the stupid choice, or else this would be a story about how they almost got eaten by the lions.
Yeah.
So I have to like give them some like a pass that way too, especially when it comes like button. You know when they introduce the button that they're gonna push it.
You have to,
They have
yeah.
to. So there's like an element of that at play. It's like, or else why would we be examining this premise otherwise?
I mean, can you imagine the story where our holodeck is malfunctioning and we're going to turn it off and call the tech to come out and look at it, and he fixes it and it's fine. And then next story.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Maybe Saturday Evening Post is not printing that story.
Yeah, they're not printing it. It doesn't fulfill like the setup of the premise, but like, I don't know. How else do you demonstrate that it's like actually bad for you? Other
Yeah.
than like bullets dodge repeatedly. We're always dodging bullets, but we don't know that we dodged it.
I mean, that's probably my takeaway is if you set up something like if you're going to explore something like this, like some idea of something going wrong,
Right.
it should go wrong in like a spectacular, like it needs to go really wrong. And like
Right.
you want the bad or something really bad to happen. If it's like a mild version of it, I don't think that's as interesting. Like we got to push the boundaries. You got to go as far as you can with whatever the story is.
Yeah.
I wrote a story a while ago where somebody didn't know if their wife had died. Turned out she didn't. And like things happened and then she came back. And I was reconsidering that story. And I was like, I think she needs to die. I
Yeah.
think it's more important to like his character or whatever that story that she doesn't come back, that she dies and he has to deal with that. It's like, can't half-ass it. You got to make the bad thing happen.
Right. You've also like given me that advice recently for like one of my stories where, you know, like people had like a whatever like kind of meh reaction to it, and you're like, I think something has to go like wildly wrong. I think something has to go like extremely badly, poorly wrong. And like for me it was hard because it was like first person, so I'd have to like invent something, you know, not that
Oh,
it's like
yeah.
hard, but like I didn't find myself wanting to do that. But anyway, like thinking about that advice for my own stuff a lot, it's like, yeah, you want that, like if there's not a climax, if a story feels flat or slow, it's probably because things haven't gone wrong enough. The climax is usually when, like, you know, it's the peak emotional height.
Yeah, that's a good way to think of it.
Yeah. Like, at least for my kind of stuff, which is like, there's no plot whatsoever.
Was exploring an emotion. So when you get to the peak of
Yeah.
that, there you go.
Yeah. And how do you evoke the strongest emotion if not by making something like outrageous than by comparison happen, right? There has to be something that's the most outrageous or the most wrong it could be. You're like, oh.
Dramatic.
Yeah, it's like that Carrie Underwood song where she's like keying the guy's car. She's like, this is what you get for cheating. And she's keying his car. Like, what if that song was like, this is what you get for cheating? And she like unfriends him on Facebook. Like, there's no peak emotional height. Gotta key his car. There has to be something like outrageous and like wrong and
I mean,
bad.
she could like cut his brake line or something.
Yeah, you're right. You're right. You're right. Instead of damaging it cosmetically, she could do something that would kill him in the vehicle. Yeah, I don't know. When I read this story, I wasn't like thinking to myself that this was some great example of XYZ. It certainly wasn't like my favorite Ray Bradbury story. Like, I love the other one, The Rain and shit.
There will come soft rains.
Yeah, like that one is a little more poignant, right? Obviously, like there's been death, and that was of a time and place where there were clear good and bad guys, right? But like in this house of this family, you're just kind of like, the kids are kind of annoying, and the parents are kind of annoying, and the psychologist I don't really care for, or whatever. None of it feels like sad. It's just like an interesting sort of commentary, and it's fun to apply these kinds of stories and to know that it was written literally 75 years ago.
Yeah.
And it still feels applicable. I mean, what would Ray Bradbury have to say about our cell phones?
I mean, that story, There Will Come Soft Rains, the full title was August 2026. There Will Come Soft
Oh
Rains. That's next year.
my God. Listen, like, I don't think that that's far off in terms of like where we're headed as a society, but I'm disappointed that there's not someone making my eggs right now. We
That's
were sold a false promise. Like, at least
right.
give us the robots first. The AI is just trying to take my fucking job.
Yeah,
The robots
badly.
are supposed to do my chores.
Take over my reason for being.
I think if nothing else, my takeaway would just be something that I've probably repeated a million times, but I think sometimes an amateur writer who doesn't think that they like sci-fi or who attempts sci-fi forgets that all it is a human story packaged in sci-fi.
Yeah, I mean, that's every genre.
It's literally every genre, right? It's fantasy, it's mystery, it's romance. I don't want to read a mystery novel solving the death of XYZ unless I care a little bit about the detective or the victim. You know what I mean? Like, I have to like care. And this is like the kind of story where it's like, it's fun to see that even with flat characters, you know, like even if I don't have this like strong emotional investment, it's a human story still. And the human story is that, like, you know, we're distracted by technology or we're damaged by it or whatever. And this just has to be this like huge, hyper spun up premise for you to get into it. That's what makes it sci-fi. Or else this would be a story, like I said, like of a day and time where like Christine is writing an article for her job and she can't finish it because Instagram is so compelling. Like, that's not very exciting. But sci-fi would be that, like, I literally get sucked into my phone and eaten by lions. And that's a fun way to get the message, right? And it's a human story because you can sympathize with Christine, who's distracted and has a goal or whatever. Like, it's a good reminder that this is such a simple story, but the reason it's like still applicable is because it's a human story. It's not about the technology of the time. It's about the fact that like people are distracted by it, harmed by it, whatever, still wrestling with the implications. Yeah, so it's not super emotional.
Like I said, every genre, right? Science fiction is like, what is it possible for us to do in the future? Fantasy is like, what if we reimagine the whole world and it was just a different world? What would we do in that world? And horror is like, what if that scary thing were really out there? You know, mystery is like, what if we had to figure out what happened? And all of these, it's always we. It's always, what if a
Yeah.
human being were in that situation? And you just imagine that situation. Gotta come back to the human being. It's gotta be about the person, about people, whether it's a specific character or people in general.
Yeah, you have to feel emotionally invested, and the only way to do that is to see something of it in yourself. And like, I can't think of an example, but like, even like when there's animals in stories, we personify them, right? And it's because we know on some level that the reader needs to like identify with the cat. Like, the cat can't just jump off a counter and walk away. It has to like have a certain look in its face that we're assigning to an emotion. We know that that's what draws us in.
The Bradbury story, There Will Come Soft Rains, there's no people in it, but we sense their absence. We get the emotion of their absence. Like they are dead, and this is what's happening since they've been gone. This is their house just continuing. And that dog comes in that house and dies. And
Yeah.
like we feel for the dog because the dog is what the humans went through. It's
Right.
left behind and it dies. And it also is like a remnant of the human life that has been lost. So, like, even when human beings are not literally there, they're
Right.
still the focus of the story and where the emotion comes from.
Well, and I would have to reread that piece, but there's even a certain tone where the house, you're sympathizing with the house.
Oh, yeah, the house is starting to fall apart.
Yeah. Well, the house is like, because there's no humans, has to be the emotional sentient thing as well. Like,
Yeah.
the house is over here just like, oh, I guess I'll turn the music on and turn the lights. You know what I
Oh,
mean?
a
It's like,
dog died in here. I better clean that up.
yeah, we still have to like insert those things or else. And we do it naturally. It's not even like intentional. It's not like Ray Bradbury was like, I gotta make the house come to life.
How do I do that?
That's how we think of things.
Yeah, our conceptual system kind of
Right.
assigns that kind of, yeah.
It's like how you throw away like rotten food and feel bad for it. You know, you're
Yeah.
like, I wish I'd eaten this apple sooner. It's poor, sad apple. So, I don't know. Like I said, this is not like my favorite sci-fi story. I don't think it's like this emotional one that I'll necessarily like. It doesn't do for me what the best sci-fi does, but it's a
Yeah.
pretty good example of like why this is applicable and long-lasting and how to do it the right way. What's your takeaway? Did you already have one?
Oh, I mentioned that thing about pushing things to the extreme, like you gotta kill the person instead
Oh,
of
that's right. Yeah.
I think I started off by saying that is probably my
I can't
takeaway.
remember, but yeah.
I don't know if there's more. Like you said, the story is not, it does what it does. It's not much more than that.
No.
Yeah, I'm not gonna take characterization away from the story.
Right.
Although I do love Wendy and Peter as the names.
Yeah, they're just little shits.
You know, they get Neverland. They literally get Neverland in their
Yeah.
house.
I was skimming to find the section where they lured the parents in, but it's like they're trying to leave for that trip or something. And the psychologist, I think, is supposed to come in when they're gone to like get rid of the shit or something. And then the kids feign like an emergency. They're like, Mom, Dad, Mom, Dad. And the parents come running and they go immediately into the nursery and then the door slams and then they get eaten. And then like the last scene is David McLean in the nursery doorway. He's like, Oh, hi. And he finds the kids. They're like, What's up? Like, our mom and dad will be here soon. And then Wendy's like, Would you like a cup of tea?
Little sociopaths
They
here.
are. And it's so funny because, like, kids left to their own devices might starve and die. But this house is going to take care of them. They have everything they need. Like, they didn't even need their parents.
That's
You know what I
right.
mean? It was, like, kind of a good little con. Well, thanks, guys.
If you enjoyed this episode, consider joining our Patreon. Your support helps us keep the show running. Find out more at patreon.com/whyisthisgoodpodcast. And for industry news, writing tips, and great short fiction, join our Facebook group at facebook.com/groups/Naples Writers Workshop. You can also subscribe to our monthly newsletter at napleswritersworkshop.com.